I am not a pastor, so I'm a little nervous. And first thing I have to say, I'm not pastors, pickleball, and pits. I think that's what I put down. But that was because Mark, the pastor here, called me and said something about these TED Talks. And he said, would you do one? And I said, I hesitated, and I must have been poor with the boundary setting. And I said, yes. He said, well, what are you going to talk about? I said, I don't know. And then he said, well, give me a title. And then somehow I said, pickleball. And then he says, pastors and pits. And so if you came to hear about pickleball, you're going to be disappointed. And I am addicted to pickleball. I play in the Meyer State Games, and when you get old like me, you can get in the upper league, and we do quite well. So, and it's Sunday afternoon. I have to admit to that, but I do go to church in the morning. So, but I am addicted to pickleball. The pastor thing probably comes out of the last 15, 20 years I've been running pastor groups. I've had the max of 6, and we meet every other week, and there's usually 6-7 pastors in a group, and it's a safe place for pastors to deal with their stuff, and the groups run something like I usually would do a devotional, and then each pastor checks in how they're doing spiritually, how they're doing with their family, how they're doing with their work. And they go around the group, and after they're done, if somebody wants to say, I need a little more help because I'm struggling with this, or my 10-year-old son is this or that, and the group gives feedback. I find out that pastors just need to be listened to, and sometimes they just need to, I don't know if the right word is vent, but they just need to talk about their stuff in a safe, confidential place. And so that's probably where the pastor's thing came in. But I'm not going to talk, well, I will talk a little bit about pastors, I have to be honest with that. But before I go on, I'm from Massachusetts, and there's a Massachusetts person there. And is Cindy here? Probably. Oh, okay. Cindy is from my hometown. And I do want to thank, if there are any Tiger fans here, I do want to thank them for Kinsler, Porcello, Price, and JD. So you guys must be just as happy as I am that the Red Sox won the World Series, right? The young man here, Stan Drenth, was in Puerto Rico, and he is a Tiger fan, and if I didn't get in the mail, well, I could tell you before, I've had stuff on my property that he put there when the with Tiger memorabilia, but I get in the mail, and here's a Dodger coffee cup. Thank you, Stan. Yeah. What I'm going to do is just a medley of thoughts. I first want to start with I have a dream on your handout kind of thing. I don't know if it's I have a dream or I had a dream, but that sometimes after working with pastors for the last 15, 20 years, I wanted to teach in the seminary. And, you know, what would I talk about? And this is a little bit of a syllabus of what I might teach the pastors or do with the pastors. And the first thing you said, you see on your sheet, storytelling, how to tell a story. Jesus was a storyteller. He told stories, and he was pretty good at it. So, and I used to do children's stories, children's messages. And it was interesting, when I did a children's message, it was always interesting to me that the adults were listening just as much as those kids were listening. People connect with stories. And So I would like to do with these seminarians is I would get a video room and I would get some kids and I would make them tell stories. And then when they tell a story, then I'd have the class watch them and give them some feedback. You're going to notice tonight I'm going to be telling a lot of different stories. And everything I say here, by the way, is confidential. So you can't go leaving here and said he said this about his wife or this about his father, anything like that. So that's just a heads up. You can do a good job telling stories or not so good. Now, when I did children's stories, one of my favorite stories, and I thought it was a good one, and it was about Rooster, and Rooster lived on the farm, and every morning he would get up and do his thing, and he would do cock-a-doodle-doo, and about 3-4 minutes later, there comes up that sun, and Rooster would strut around the barnyard, and the animals, pig, sheep, cow, would say, "Good job, Rooster, that's the way you do it." Well, one night, Rooster went out and went to a party, and he slept in. Got up about 9, the sun is up, and the animals are all outside of his coop saying, yeah, Rooster, all these years you've been making us think that you made that sun come up. And Rooster really did. In fact, he worried about that a lot, that if he did sleep in, what was going to happen? Because if you didn't have the sun, things wouldn't grow, etc. Later in the day, Rooster's walking around singing, "Oh, what a relief it is." That he wasn't responsible for that sun coming up. Now, that's a good message for children because children, if you ask them, "Well, who makes that sun?" they'll come up with the answer. And there's also a message in there for adults because sometimes we're worrying about things and we're obsessing and anxious about things that we really shouldn't be. Now, there's also this summer I took my family, every other summer I take the kids, I got 11 grandchildren, 4 kids, we go somewhere and I'll pay the lodging and they'll pay for the activities, but this summer we went to Hershey, Pennsylvania and we rented a renovated barn and every family had their own bathroom, etc., room, and at night they call, I'm Papa, and I would have a devotion and I would tell children's stories. This will be an example of a children's story that was not very good, and you'll find out why. The story was about Nathan and Trevor, 2 donkeys, and donkeys in biblical time were like semi-trucks. You know, they carried loads from town to town. Well, Nathan and Trevor were going from one town to another, and Nathan was carrying a load of salt, and Trevor had a load of sponges, and it was kind of a wet time of the year, and they came to kind of a brook, but had gone into a pretty deep stream. And Trevor, the youngest donkey, says, "I don't know, Nathan, shouldn't go in that stream." Trevor says, "Yeah, we go in that stream." He says, "I'll go first, because if your hoofs don't stay on the ground, you can swim." So Trevor said, "All right." So Nathan goes first, and he goes in there, and pretty soon he couldn't touch the bottom, but he could swim and got on the other side, and he got on the other side of the stream, and he says, Trevor, something wonderful has happened to me. I've lost my load." And Trevor says, "Oh, I'm coming." So in goes Trevor. Now remember what Trevor's carrying. So Trevor gets in there, and all of a sudden, his hoofs are on the ground, and all of a sudden, he can't make it. And down he goes. So I tell the story. He says, "Now, kids, you know, when you do something wrong and you don't confess, it's a little bit like Trevor. Things just weigh you down. And but if you're like Nathan, and the salt, you know, the water took it away. When you confess things, it's like you lost your load." Well, 10-year-old says, "What in the world happened to Trevor? The only thing all those kids were concerned about was Trevor. Did he die, Dad? Papa, that was a horrible story. just a horrible story. They could care less about confession or anything like that. It was that Trevor died. And how could I tell such a story? The next thing I just want to say a few things about other classrooms of life. I would like to have these seminary students tell me not about their academic classrooms, but I want to know about their classrooms of life. I was on the search team. We just got a new minister in Jamestown, and he had a great resume and academically really strong. But my question of him was, outside of these academic classrooms, tell me about a classroom of life that taught you a lot. And he said, my best classroom was for the last 3 years I was in seminary. I worked the second shift at Amway. I said, really? And I said, why is that a good classroom? He says, I was in customer service, and I had to handle all the complaints. He said, I learned more about people than in any classroom I've been in. And he's learned about what they struggle with and how to deal with people that are very angry. And that was a classroom of life for him. One of my classrooms was after going to Calvin, I went to Michigan State. I'm sorry for Stan, who's a Michigan fan right away. In between my first and second year of school, I went to live in Harlem, New York. New York, New York. If you're from Massachusetts, that R is just a problem. So I spent 4 months living in Harlem and living on a second floor in a brownstone. There were a couple other white people there, but I got up every morning. I was white. My job was working in Uppertown, New York, in a Spence Chapman Adoption Agency, a Jewish agency, where I did 20 home studies. And doing the home studies, I would have to, for adoption, you always had to go to their home. And I went to Long Island, public transportation, went all over and met all kinds of different people. Plus, working in a Jewish agency taught me so much. That was a classroom of life that I was getting paid to do this, but I was learning more than some of the tuition payments for some of the courses I took. So I want to know from these seminary students what was an important classroom in their life and why. So that would be the second part of the course I'd be taking. Then I would want to move on to, and this is what I'm going to spend a little more time on, family genograms. In my pastor groups, each pastor would have to do a family genogram. And tell them how to do it, and then they had to go home, do it, and then bring it to the group and share that. Now, has anybody here done a family genogram? Raise your hand. Stan was in one of my groups. Now, that's interesting. I'm going to encourage you to do a family genogram, and what I'm going to do right now is tell you a little bit on how to do it. Why did I make the pastors do a family genogram? It's because it's not that you can change your family, but there's going to be a ton that you can learn from it. And so what I did up here was I did a family genogram. And anybody guess whose family this is? My family. And so I'm going to go through this, and you'll learn some things about me, but you're also going to be learning some things. I'll tell you how to do it. On this side is my grandparents, and this is my mother. And you can see she was what? Only child. She was a musician. Played the organ, taught music, piano and organ, led choirs. She was an only child. Over here is my grandparents on my dad's side. Now, my dad was the youngest in his family. He had an older brother, an older sister, and an older brother. Now, the interesting thing, his mother died in childbirth. So for the first 2 years of his life, he was shipped out to different homes. Then, when he was 10, his father died. And his father, let me back up. See, his mother died, and before that, his father remarried another person. And so they had two children. When he was gone, dad remarried, got two children, and then he came back, and this was, he called her the wicked stepmom. Okay? Because these two kids were much more important than him. When he was 10, his dad died. So then he boarded out and worked in farms, quit school, and that was it. He met my mother, and you can see already the differences in history, in just... So he married my mother, and they had four children. My sister is the oldest, then I have an older brother. This is me, and I have a younger brother. These people became very important to me because these were the only grandparents. We were the only grandchildren. So you can see that was significant. My older sister did get a divorce. Husband ran away, left her with five children, which was a significant event in our family. I have an older brother, and he's in Philadelphia, and this guy was in the military. I ended up marrying this person, and we have 1, 2, 3, 4 children. Okay? Now, the interesting thing about this is this person, if I did her, I could do her family genogram. She's non-Dutch, never heard of the Reformed, the Christian Reformed Church, didn't grow up in a Christian home, had five siblings with a lot of divorces in her family. We met and came to Michigan, and everybody said, "Well, where'd you meet Hank? And what do you think people said?" Church? No. Calvin. You must have gone to Calvin. Linda said, "No." "And where are you from, Linda?" "Well, I'm from Wisconsin." "Oh, from Oostburg?" "No." "From Sheboygan?" They went through every Dutch town. And she says, "Why are they saying that?" "Well, they think you're Dutch." Of course, I had to instruct Linda about the Dutch people a little bit, and that they tend to be a little frugal, very tight with money, and that reminds me of the elderly Dutch couple that he died, and his wife said, "You know, I should put something in an obituary." So she went down to the newspaper, and she says, "I'd like to put something in the obituary. How much is it a word?" And the guy says, $5 a word." $5 a word?" He said, "Yeah. Just put Henry died." The guy said, "It's a five-word minimum. A five-word minimum." She paused. She says, "Just put Henry died, Buick for sale." So I had to instruct my wife a little bit about the Dutch culture. So you can see, you know, and if I had the seminarians, if they did this, as the pastors did, you start learning some things. You know, you could, you know, if I did this in the group, they said, "Well, how did your dad and mom meet, or how did dad function as a father?" Because there would be some of those questions. So I just think that's important. So I would encourage everybody, if you want to have some fun, is do a family genogram. Begin to, you know, my dad was more structured. My mother was a nurturer. I could talk about my sister. I could talk about my older brother, my younger brother, some of the things. So I'd encourage you to do a genogram. Now, any questions on this? Was it a good experience for you, Stan? Okay. It's a good thing you said that. What was that? You know, I'm tempted to say some things because he's my one of my pickleball players, and ever since he retired, you used to say, Barb, that I was his imaginary friend. You know, you didn't meet me for a while. When he was a pastor, we would play pickleball a couple times a week. Ever since he's retired and he's driving in on time, it's like I don't exist anymore. So it's a major. He doesn't need the therapy. That's a good point. One other thing I would do with these seminarians, I would have them do a home visit. You say, what do you mean a home visit? I mean, I would get a family, bring him into the seminary, and I would have the seminarian pretend he's going to their home, and I would want the seminarian to get their story, to find out what their story is, to find out who they are, and how would they do that. Why I say that, in the 60s, after I got out of school, I worked in the school system as a school social worker for 1 year, and I just didn't like it because I was in six different schools, and I would they would refer kids to me, and I would meet with the kids, and then I would meet with the family, and then I'd kind of instruct the teacher what to do. And I wasn't always sure if the teacher was doing what I thought they should do, if they did it in the right way. So I quit after 1 year, and I said, I'm going to teach school. And in those days, I didn't have a teaching certificate, but you could get 90-day certificates. And so I taught at Madison Park School in Grand Rapids in the fifth grade, and this was in the late 60s. And this was an inner-city school. All my students were African-American. And I said, how am I going to survive? Because one of the teachers says, you know, you're not going to last very long. So in August, I got my class list, and what do you think I did? What? I prayed for those kids, yeah, but I did something else. I went to each one of their homes, and I'd call up the parents, and I'm going to be a teacher, and I'm wondering if I can meet with you. Yeah, and so I'd go to set up a time and went go, and I'd sit down and said, tell me about your son or daughter. What's their experience been like in school? What do you see as their strengths and their weaknesses? Do you see certain things you're concerned about? What do you want me to do if there's a problem? That month was the most valuable thing because I got the sense of their family, if it was a single parent or if their both parents were there. I got a sense of who they were. If I didn't have that, I wouldn't have survived. I can still remember, see, I'm telling stories now. His name was Ralph Rhodes. Ralph's mother was a beautiful person, but his father was in prison. I can remember the classroom. We sat behind this girl who had pigtails. yanking those things. I said, "Ralph, knock it off." And if he didn't do it again, I said, "Ralph, I'm not listening to any damn white honky." Got up and he left. And this was about within the first couple of weeks of school. I said, "Now what am I going to do?" I remember what his mom said. And so I said to the classroom, "I'm leaving." I went up, and the principal was African American. He says, "Ralph's headed home." I says, "Do you mind if I follow him home?" So there we are, walking down Madison by the old Grand Rapids Christian High School. Ralph's about up by the exit sign. I'm just walking. He's looking. I just keep walking. I said, "I know where your home is, Ralph. I can find it too." Finally, he stopped. He turned around and he says, "I don't want you to tell my mother." I said, "She's going to find out, Ralph, but you got to come back. I don't know if you really want to come home." And there sits Mom. He didn't want to do that. He turned around and came back. I had a lot of experiences like that, that I felt very comfortable going to their home if there was a problem. Now, in the church, when I grew up, and maybe most of you when you grew up, we had this old thing of house bazook. Oh, yeah. Boy, I can still remember that. You know, us four kids line up, sit there, and in came the minister and an elder or two elders, and there you sat. "Now, are you going to catechism?" And, you know, hated it. Just hated it. They never listened to our story. It was almost like an examination. Now, the church, I don't know if they do it at Georgetown. They don't do that very much anymore. I became an elder two, three years ago again, and so I get 20 in my household, and what I said I'm going to do, I says I'm going to do a house visit. And so for the first year, I would try to do two a month, and out of the 20, 22 people, one person said they didn't want a house visit. Only one. And when I went, I listened to stories. I says, "Tell me about your work. Tell me about your hobbies. Tell me about your kids." And if the kids were there, I'd do my homework first. I knew what grade they were in, and I'd ask all these things. I remember the first person I asked about home, he says, "Yeah, you can come." It was an older guy. He says, "I don't want to talk about church stuff." I says, "No problem." I came and came into the house, and he says, "I want to show you my workshop." For a half hour, we were in his basement. He was showing me what kind of craft work he did. Then we went up and we talked, and I listened to part of their story, listened to some of the losses they experienced, family stuff that I didn't know about. A year later, his wife got very sick. That made it so easy for me to enter their home. That's why I would want to instruct the seminarians how to do that. You know, you may say seminarians feel very comfortable doing that. They don't. There was the recent article in the Banner. Elders are called to a ministry of presence. It's a great article, and it was. It says here, one of the chief ways elders exercise spiritual leadership is by loving congregants and being aware of how God is at work among them. To love congregants, the elder has to be with them. Historically, the primary way this is taking place in our denomination is through the ministry of home visitation. And then the guy goes on, the person writing this says, it's not happening anymore. And then his point would be, to love congregants, the elder has to be with them, to know them. I would say that's also true for pastors. Which leads me that since I'm a guest teacher at this seminary, I'm going to ask to be a delegate to synod or something, and I'm going to say, I think that every time a minister comes to a church, he shouldn't have to preach for 2 months. In the first 2 months, Everybody in the church has to sign up for a home visit. And he has to go to the home, and he just has to listen to their story and ask questions. If he or she would do that, you know, pastors sometimes, a lot of them drop out. A lot of them, the stress is too much. This would be like when I taught school. If I didn't do those home visits, I don't think I would have survived. I think that same analogy can be used with pastors, that if they got into the homes and had 2 months to do that, their preaching, people would know them, but he would know them. It reminds me that one of my friends, a pastor, went to this, not this last synod, 2 synods ago, and I said, how'd it go? He says, I did an experiment. I said, you did an experiment. What was the experiment? He said, all during synod, he says, I was very attentive to other people and would ask them questions. I wanted to find out what they were doing, what their story was. I said, how did that go? Oh, he says, I learned a lot of things. But he says, you know what happened, Hank? I says, no, what happened? He said, not once did anybody ask me about my story. He said, they didn't even know if I was an elder or a pastor. He says, except one person. They said, well, are you an elder or a pastor? He said, I'm a pastor. And they went right on with their story. Now, that's interesting. I don't know if you found that. I find that a lot, that I love to ask people questions. But very times, I can go on trips and I can start asking people questions, and if I meet them at McDonald's, nobody asks me questions. Very seldom do they ask me anything about myself. I think one of the speakers later is going to talk about how do you listen. People want to tell their stories, but people seem very uncomfortable asking other people their stories. I notice that even in our church sometimes. A new person will come. We're getting a lot of new people. And sometimes I just kind of, because they stand there, and nobody seems to feel comfortable, say, hey, I'm Hank, what's your name? And you're visiting today? Yeah, and where are you from? Well, this past Sunday, I'm from South Dakota. I said, South Dakota, what brings you to Jamestown? Well, one of our children here, and we wanted to be around grandchildren. I see. I says, and are you're just visiting? Yeah, we've been here once before. I said, oh, you're a finalist. I said, a finalist? Yeah, we narrowed it down. We got 2 churches, and you're in the finals. That's good news. I said, well, that's awesome. I said, I love that. And the lady says, what's your church background? Oh, and these people they're not hesitant. Says, well, I'm from a Catholic background, and my husband's a Baptist. I says, how's that work? and we just had a good talk, maybe 5-10 minutes. And I think it's almost like I want elders and the seminarians to feel so comfortable. And I say, boy, we need to be more comfortable. Because people will talk. You know, it's just asking them questions. All right, I'm going to switch now to the other side. 40 years as a therapist, oh my goodness. Is there any comments or questions to what I've said so far, or does this resonate with any of you guys? Oh boy, what am I going to say here? What, make it up? These are some of the things that have helped me in my family, and I've learned this in my work. If I misspell something, it's because those teachers they sent out to Whitensville from Michigan didn't understand our phonics system. That's just the way it is. They didn't understand our language either. If I asked you, what is the difference between goals and desires? What might you say? Okay. Yeah, that's very good. Goals you have control over, desires you have no control. Okay. Desires would probably be you need the cooperation of somebody else if we're talking about relationships. Goals are something you have control over, so that means you work on them, you do them. Okay. Desires, you pray about them. Now, what happens with people, what I've learned in my work and even in my own life, people tend to work on desires. And when they work on desires, what do you think happens? Frustration, you nailed it. They get so frustrated, and then they work a little harder, and then sometimes they even give up. I'm going to tell you another story. I have four children. They're all good kids. But now remember, this is all confidential. Everybody agree with that? You're not going to walk out of here. So the third child, a girl, it seems like right from the beginning, she, I'm a teaser and stuff like that, and I would say, she would be 4 or 5, says, "Dad needs a hug." And look at me. I could not get any warmth out of this kid, it seemed. She said, the youngest one would see that, who's 2 years younger, the younger one would end up giving me a hug. I would try everything to get a little connection with her. And she just kind of held me away. So finally, as you can see, my desire would be that she would respond with some affection and warmth. And I was working on it like crazy. Frustrated, so finally I said, fine, not going to lead with get my chin bopped anymore. I said, I'm just going to kind of ignore her. So I was doing that, and finally my wife, Linda, says to me, what are you doing with Susan? I says, I'm ignoring her. She says, that's horrible. I looked at her and said, I'm the therapist. You know, I didn't say that to her. I said, She says, how can you do that? I says, it's easy. She says, you're not loving her. And I, as I rode to work, I said, oh, stinkers. She's right. And then I remember this distinction. And I said, I'm going to work on goals, something that I have control over. And I can still remember them to this day, what they were. One compliment a day. I didn't do it every day, but Susan, your room is the neatest. Boy, Sue, when you color, that's just beautiful. You know, every time we have a meal and I call you kids, you just come running. I like your hair. Okay? I was accomplishing my goal, and I wasn't basing my goal on whether the desire would be achieved or not. She liked to go bike riding, so my goal was 2 times a week I'd ask her, do you want to go bike riding? She was a little more of a tomboy. If she said yes, great. If she said no, I still accomplished my goal. The third goal, it's amazing, that's been 30, 40 years ago, was gymnastics. Gymnastics was when I came home from work, they would be at one part of the house and run like crazy and then jump and they'd do a leg and then I'd have a board and I'd score at 6.9, 9.8, everything. Okay? That's a goal. And you work on that. I prayed on the desires. Now, she's a great kid, and I remember she came back from school once and Sunday morning and I was reading the paper and she came up and I said, boy, did you package yourself well. You look awesome. Walked right by me into the bathroom and kind of slammed the door. I said, compliment. I said, oh, I wanted to, you know, part of me wanted to wring her neck. After church, she says, you like my outfit? I said, yes, I did. She says, you haven't figured it out yet? I said, figured out what? She says, in the morning, don't give me this stuff. I'm just waking up. I says, "I how did I blow that? I says, I'm sorry. Now, you know, a desire would be he or she would understand how I feel. This could be a marital relation. I wish my wife would understand how I feel. I wish my husband would understand how I feel. That's a desire. The goal could be what? You could, what? You could write a letter. Right? You have control over it. So you write a letter and how you feel. That has helped me in relationships. What do I have control over? I work on, I do. I pray for the desires. I may try to set some goals that may affect the desires, but the desires always involve cooperation of somebody else. Stinking thinking, that to me has also been very helpful to me. One of my favorite verses in the Bible is, I think it's Philippians 4, verse 8. So brothers, sisters, whatever you do, train your brain to think about the things that are good, holy, whatever is acceptable, praiseworthy. Focus on that. But people, this thinking, I remember the pastor coming to group once and said, looking like death warmed over. And I said, wow, what's happening? Well, he says the last Sunday, he says, as I was shaking hands, people walking out, people said to me, that wasn't your best, Pastor. And he says, I don't know. He says, sometimes I'm sick. I'm ready to quit this stuff. I can't do it. And but I don't know what else I can do because I'm trained. I spent all this money, all this education being a pastor. And he was really kind of depressed. And that reminded me of the all or nothing. You don't always have your A game. Life is a blend. So if I play pickleball, sometimes today I played pickleball, and I had my ranking, you know, maybe a 3-5 or 4. But today I think I played a 2-5. I couldn't hit the third shot. But I didn't get depressed because you don't always have your A game in pickleball. Life is a blend, and you got to learn to not get into this all or nothing type of living. The second thing, mountains out of molehills, my youngest daughter and I have some great conversations, and sometimes she makes the mountains out of molehills. She pays emotionally too much for the event that happens in her life. If you go shopping and I see a pickleball paddle that I really want and it's $70, but it's just the one I want, and I say, well, I'll pay $140. If I shop like that, I would go broke. But sometimes in life, that's what we do. The event, we pay emotionally double what it's worth. And sometimes my daughter, I says, that's not a dollar event, that's a nickel event. When growing up, it seemed like the three boys sometimes would reach a lot, and my mother would say, can we get through one meal without somebody spilling? And she would, I said, that's just a nickel event, Mom. Don't make it a dollar. Because if you do, and if you live life and you pay too much for the events in your life, you go emotionally broke. And some people, they get that type of thinking, and it's stinking thinking. Another one is the, I caused it. I remember the young lady coming to me. I remember this very clearly. She says, he didn't talk to me. I says, what do you mean he didn't talk to me? He always says something to me. He hasn't talked to me the last couple days. She says, it must be because of what I wear. I changed my hair, and I don't think he likes the way I did my hair. I said, oh, really? She says, why is he not talking to me? I said, well, I bet he didn't clean the garage and his dad yelled at him. I says, or maybe he's coming down with the flu. Or said, what else was it? I had some other reasons. All these reasons that could be the reason he was quiet. I said, maybe he's fighting some depression. I don't know, I throw out all kinds of things. I says, don't think you caused everything. Why people do things most of the time is because of what's happening in their life. So don't start thinking that you're that powerful that you cause what other people are doing. Those are just some of the stinking thinking things. I want to move on to discipline because when I discipline, I tell my kids, I says, I wish you'd do this with your children. The big thing with them is timeouts. Well, what I did was I always gave writing assignments. I can still remember Kirk, my oldest, and the second oldest, they were fighting all the time. So I says, you guys, why do parents get upset when their children fight? And you got to write two paragraphs. Kirk's was, and he was, I don't know, he's seven or six, or I don't know how old. It upsets their senses, and they have five of them. And then he listed them. And he says, it also reminds them of their childhood. That it must be that they have a bad childhood. Now, when you do this, they also start to write back. And this is a letter was under my pillow, because I gave a lot of writing assignments. Dear Mom, and then Dad underlined. And I got this when I was working in the adolescent unit at Pine Rest. I wish you would have gone to that skills thing, because you don't know how I feel. I feel like you think that I have no feelings at all. Carrie's always the perfect angel. How do you know that she's not lying or something like that? She's not always right. I feel like I am ignored and left out. I'm always competing with Carrie with grades, handwriting, art. Plus, I'm going through adolescence. And she was mad at me because I didn't go to this adolescent skill thing. So you have to understand my feelings and changes, underline. I've been a pain today. But can't you remember when you were a pain? I just had to tell you this. Love, Susan. I got this one typed because she came to me and says, I don't want to take piano lessons anymore. I says, well, write me about it. Tell me why you don't want to take piano lessons. This letter is concerning piano lessons. I really want to work something out. I feel I'm way too busy. I'm surprised I had time to write this letter. I've been really frustrated with the piano for quite some time now. I don't think like I'm going anywhere. I don't think I'm very good because I can't play duets with Mother. Mother always asks Sue to play with you. Play with Carrie. But I never get any compliments. Kids at school are much better than me. Another thing is I don't like to practice piano, so I don't do my best. I'd rather be a flute player. I like flute so much, and I'd probably make more progress if I quit piano. Let Susan be the piano player. Maybe we can work out a compromise. Let me take lessons every other week. This would work well because I have Calvinettes every other week. This way I will not be so swamped on Wednesdays. I'm not totally in favor of this solution. So let's quit piano when our basketball season starts. School will be my first priority during basketball. Basketball will be second, flute third, and piano will come in last, if even at all. If you don't agree with that, let me take it for summer only. Then I'll have time to do my schoolwork and assignments completely. I also won't be so tired during the day because I can get my homework done on time. I wanted to do so many things this year but couldn't because of that piano. One example is dance. I want to take dance so bad this year. I was so excited because I thought I was going to be able to take private lessons. It turned out I can't because I'm already too busy. One more example is having friends over. Wednesday is the only day you have off, so it's the only day I can have friends over. But now I can't because of lessons. In conclusion, I think you ought to let me quit. I'm way too busy and I'm not going anywhere. Please consider the points I have brought up in this letter before you give me an answer. It doesn't get any better than that. This reminds me, you remember I did the family genogram of my parents and my dad's, and he was a disciplinarian, and, you know, kids need nurture and structure. And when my dad, this was after my mother died, my dad, I always called him on Thursdays. And he was in Massachusetts, I'm in Michigan, and, you know, first part of the conversation is, did you get your driveway tired, or are you just going to keep that driveway? And I says, yeah, I'm going to get it tired. Well, he says, do you know why Paul could do what he did? And all of a sudden, I felt like I was in catechism class. I said, Paul. And I just hesitated. Well, do you know what he did? Yeah, he wrote the epistles. Yeah. Oh, and he said he was a missionary. Yeah. Well, how could he do that? I'm still not getting it. I says, God's Spirit. I thought that would be a safe answer. Yeah, no. Well, do you know what he did before? Oh, I says, yeah. I says, he went about with murderous intent killing Christians. Yeah, yeah. So how could he do that? I says, he had to forgive himself. Yeah. He says, you know, your mother was the nurturer. I said, yeah. And he would pause. I says, you have to forgive yourself? Yeah, he says, I should have nurtured more. One of the things I've learned in counseling is that people have to learn to forgive. Forgiveness is canceling what somebody owes you that they can't pay. That's what it really is, because of what God canceled for us. But we also have to learn to forgive ourselves. And my dad had, I don't know, he learned that through God's Spirit because, you know, he really never was really parented. One other story about him that when I was at Calvin, and I don't know how he did this, but I was a sophomore, I'm going to be a junior, and he said, wrote me a letter, always got a letter. He says, maybe that's why I did this letter writing with my kids. I just thought of that. And he says, your mother and I would like you to go on a swim team, summer workshop and missions. I looked at that. He says, your area that from the is going to Colorado, Boulder, Colorado. My roommate says, well, you're going to go? I says, no way. So I wrote back and I says, Dad, that's a great idea. I'll miss 6 weeks of work. So I'm not going. I got a letter back. Your mother and I decided that we would give you $600. I can make $100 a week at Koopman's. That's a lumber place in Massachusetts. And my roommate said, he's got you now. I says, no, he doesn't. I says, no, I'm not going. I says, he's going to give you $600. I says, I know, that's not like him. But so I wrote back and I says, that's a great idea. But I says, 6 weeks from June. I come back in the middle of July, no job. I lose another 600. Wrote that in the letter. I had them now. What do you think he did? What? No, no. He went to Koopman and said, would you, and this is, my dad was one, you look for the job. Not. He went to Koopman and said, would you hire Hank when he gets here in the middle of July? Koopman said, no problem. And my roommate laughed like crazy. I went. Been another type of classroom of life. And that's what you do as parents. You set up this kind of stuff. You make it impossible for your kids to not do that. I'm gonna stop because it's. I already told you I didn't have good boundaries. I said yes to Mark, and I didn't really want to do it. But but that's enough for tonight. Thank you. I'll just close with a word of prayer. Lord, I just want to thank you for loving us in spite of the flaws that we have, and that nothing that we do can make you love us less. Nothing can separate us from that love. So I pray that as we journey in life, and that we know that you journey with us, thank you for that. And be with us now as we deal with children, with life issues. Give us the ability to forgive. Give us the ability to forgive ourselves. Give us the ability to tell others our story. We just ask this in your name. Amen.